All right, Dave, we are back with episode 34 of World War Civ. This is a particularly harrowing and tragic episode. If people, what can I say? Just, I guess I have to give that warning. We're talking about the Armenian genocide of 1915 and 1916 here. So this is, I didn't want to not do this. Otherwise, we would be like, 150 countries of the world that don't acknowledge that this happened. You were just saying, Dave.
That was my biggest surprise researching this. There are only 31 countries in the world that recognize that this actually happened.
So the politics of the foreign policy of the Turkish government, I suppose, for the past 100 years has been, if you want to have good relations with us, we don't talk about this, I suppose.
Right.
So what's it? Yeah. I mean, there's so many things. We'll get into all of it. But I wanted to say that, this is 1915-16. So we've already talked about this period in other contexts. We've talked about Gallipoli and the Dardanelles invasions. We've talked about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. These were all, if you go back to the World War Civ episodes where we talked about those things, you should just know that this is happening at the same time as those mm-hmm. things are happening. So this is Ottoman Turkey during World War One, and all of we're covering different aspects of the war so that we can make sure that we stay in sync. We don't want to get too far ahead or behind chronologically as we go. So I wanted to say I was using a couple of sources, but the one I relied on the most is Taner Akçam, I think is how you pronounce it, T-A-N-E-R, and then the last name is A-K-C-A-M. So Taner Akçam, and Taner Akçam has written a bunch of books, like 4 or 5 books about the Armenian genocide. So this is not an area, Dave, where, like I've said this many times before about Turkey, like I don't have a lot of personal connections to Turkey. I've never been to Turkey. I don't have a lot of personal connections to Armenia. It's just reading for me. Like, it's just what I've read. It's just research for me.
Okay. Well, I've been to Turkey for a short visit, and I have to say that I was very, very impressed. Certainly among the most hospitable people in the world that I've ever met. So it's hard to reconcile these things.
Yeah, I mean, geopolitics and regime politics are totally different, right?
So, yeah, yeah.
So Taner, I gather, is Turkish and not Armenian, but like Turkish, whatever that means, and lives in Germany, I believe. Is a professor in Germany. So it's an academic approach, very academic work in the good sense too, like lots of footnotes and very careful appraisal of sources and very careful and explicit evaluation of things. So it's as someone who's not knowledgeable about this, it's great to read someone like that because it's so transparent about where it's coming from. And Akçam is kind of a dissident Turkish person. He's been imprisoned for a variety of things. He was imprisoned for activism on the Kurdish question. So he's known as someone who's pro-Kurdish as a Turk. There are lots of Turkish people that are like this, and Turkish intellectuals. He was a good friend of a journalist named Hrant Dink, who I think is pretty famous in Turkish intellectual and activist circles, who was assassinated in 2007. That same year, Taner Akçam was detained in Canada and in the U.S. when he was traveling, and it was essentially for doing this work on the Armenian genocide. So I guess the Turkish government accuses him of all kinds of things, and other governments that want to stay on Turkey's good side have done various little things to discredit his work. So the main book that I'm using here is called The Young Turks: Crime Against Humanity, The Armenian Genocide and Ethnic Cleansing in the Ottoman Empire, which is from 2012, and it's by Princeton University Press. And there are a couple of other books by the same author that I also used. One is a edited book called Judgment at Istanbul, the Armenian Genocide Trials, referring to the 1919-20 trials. We'll briefly mention these at the end. And another book called called From Empire to Republic, Turkish Nationalism and the Armenian Genocide. So there's, like I said, Taner Akçam has written a lot on this topic. So the overall analysis in The Young Turks' Crime Against Humanity is that the politics at the time, and we're still living in this era in a sense, their regime hasn't changed its official view. There were two framings. The way the Armenian minority and other minorities see it are these are minorities who were happy to see the fall of the Ottoman Empire because they saw the fall of the Ottoman Empire as giving them their national rights, potentially. And then there's the Turkish national view, which is that the imperialists were out to get Turkey and dismantle Turkey and dismember Turkey. And the minorities, including the Armenians, were being used as tools by the imperialists in that objective. So obviously, I think we should say these are both true. These are both views that are understandable and fairly cogent, logical views that can be taken on what's going on and what was going on in this period of Turkish and world history. So Taner, again, and Taner is someone he's able to kind of hold these views despite not endorsing them. So he talks about the Turkish nationalist view. He says, from the Turkish nationalist point of view, the Armenian genocide was, quote, a tragic but unintended byproduct of the war. And the Turkish nationalist view is that there's no reliable evidence of a deliberate policy of systemic killing. In this view, the only source of reliable evidence on the topic is the Prime Ministerial Ottoman Archive in Istanbul. Foreign archives like British, German, American and Austrian, as well as the domestic proceedings of the Istanbul court martial, are dismissed as politically motivated distortions of the events. And on the other hand, so that's the end of the quote. And on the other hand, people who claim genocide dismiss the Ottoman records as falsified. And so what Akçam is trying to do in his book is argue that actually, when you look at the archives together, he says they, quote, jointly confirm that the ruling party, CUP, Committee of Union and Progress, did deliberately implement a policy of ethno-religious homogenization of Anatolia, which is the, what would you call Anatolia? Like Turkey. I don't know how to put it exactly, but like
modern. Yeah.
Like the Ottoman Empire is Turkey plus all these other areas, and Turkey, what you would call Turkey, is Anatolia, the Anatolian Peninsula. Is it a peninsula?
Kind of. Yeah, it's the Turkish heartland. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah. So an ethno-religious homogenization of Anatolia that aimed to destroy the Armenian population. So Akçam is arguing that you don't need to skip one or another set of sources to conclude that this was a genocidal policy. You can actually study things carefully and realize that it was, in fact, a genocide.
Well, it's a polite way of saying don't draw your conclusions without reading some of the information.
Yeah, without reading the other side.
Well, I mean, the whole denial thing is interesting because the Ottoman Empire had so many prior cases of doing the same things. So I found out, I did not know this, but the Armenians were spread not just in modern day Armenia, but they were spread all over Anatolia and heavily concentrated in eastern Anatolia. And many of these Armenian villages were under Kurdish landlords.
There's a big Kurdish Armenian problem in the areas where there are big Armenian populations. I read something about like six districts or something.
Yeah,
like six key districts.
Yeah, but part of the problem is that the Ottomans basically eliminated the Kurdish emirates in the middle of the 19th century. And that meant that they wanted those Armenian villages to pay their taxes to the central government. But the Kurdish landlords weren't willing to give up that revenue, so they insisted on still being paid. So now the Armenian population are paying taxes to two separate overlords. In the 1890s, there were forced conversions and the Hamidian massacres. So we did an episode on the Young Turks and spent a bunch of time on Sultan Abdulhamid, lovely guy, but he saw the Armenians as possible threat, danger, and was all too happy to stir up hatred against them and declare open season. So if you want to rob them and kill them, go ahead. There will be no punishment. There may even be rewards. So in 1890-91, Abdul Hamid gave semi-official status to Kurdish bandits, to Turks, Arabs, Turkmen and Circassians, armed them. And so they came to be called the Hamidian regiments. And these basically brigands were given free rein to attack Armenians, to confiscate their grain, their food, drive off livestock. And they were perfectly confident of escaping punishment for any crimes because they were subject to military courts only. And in these massacres, the estimated death toll was 100,000.
So this is like living off, this is like raising a militia and allowing them to live off the land, and live off the land meaning live as predatory on the local population, which is a different ethnicity.
I would change one word there, from allowing to encouraging.
Right.
This spilled over into what's known as the Diyarbakir massacres aimed at Assyrian Christians. And if we go further.
Is Diyarbakir currently in Turkey, or is it in Georgia now or somewhere else? I'm going to look it up while you continue.
Okay. I thought the Assyrian Christians were in Iraq, but oh yeah, check it out. I'm not 100%
sure. No, it's Turkey. It's Turkey. It's the largest Kurdish majority city in Turkey now.
Okay. Yeah, we've covered in so many episodes the Ottoman history of responding to rebellion or political unrest or imagined political unrest and you know, threats with massacres. In the Greek War of Independence, 1824, Turkish forces landed on the island of Kos and slaughtered most of the population and sold the rest off. And we covered the Bulgarian massacres of 1876, 1878, the ones that had Gladstone so horrified and enraged. And then these massacres were met with reprisal massacres against Turkish civilians. I mean, on a smaller scale, but then that gives the Ottoman government, you know, the ability to point the finger and go, there, that's what we were talking about. So given these early massacres, there were some Armenians who joined groups like the ARF, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. And early on, this group decided to ally with the Young Turks, because the Young Turks were going to force a constitution on Abdul Hamid, or even overthrow him. And that would have pleased the Armenians. But the Armenians grew more and more skeptical of the CUP, as it was called, the Committee of Union and Progress, led by Mehmed Talat, because the Turks were becoming more and more overtly nationalist. And their version of union didn't leave a lot of room for self-determination for national minorities. In 1909, and this is after the Young Turks rising, Turkish authorities failed to intervene to prevent a massacre in Adana. 17,000 were killed.
By like a mob kind of thing?
Yeah, but that's a pretty big mob. That sounds like, you know, state more than a day.
Weapons, yeah. I just want to say, just please, to listeners, Mehmet Talat and the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, just remember those because they're going to have another encounter.
Oh, God.
Sometime around 1921.
Yeah, yes, that's right. That's right. So Ottoman authorities denied any responsibility for these massacres and accused Western powers of meddling, accused the Armenians of provocation, and presented Muslims as the main victims. But then, you know, failing to punish any perpetrators. I mean, you're not going to find as many perpetrators of massacres against Muslims because there weren't that many or as many, but you have nobody responsible for the deaths of these Armenians. So that's kind of the formula that they're going to stick to.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of the Turkish narrative, again, I'm calling it a narrative, but I'm not saying it's not true or doesn't have elements that are factual. Mm-hmm. So their analysis or their reading is the Balkan Wars, which we covered pretty extensively, of 1912-1913, the Ottoman Empire lost 60%, 80% of its European lands and 70% of its European population at the end of that war. They had already lost 60% of their territory over the course of the 19th century. And after the Balkan War, these Balkan Muslims, this 70% of the European population, they go to the Turkish heartland of Anatolia. And one of the Committee of Union and Progress leaders, Enver Pasha, who I want to spoil what happens, but listen carefully to that name because you're going to hear that name again and again. Enver Pasha starts talking about the non-Turkish elements of Turkey, which has a lot to, which is code word for Christians mainly, being a tumor that has to be purged. So cancer language is never a good sign in terms of leading up to a genocide.
No. Apparently the refugees from the European lands added up to hundreds of thousands. And many, many of these were resettled in eastern Anatolia. And that meant next to or on land confiscated from Armenians.
Yes.
So that's not going to endear them to the Armenians. But you're right, you know, coming from their experience of being kicked out of the European section of the Turkish Empire, they're not going to have very warm feelings for Christians. Because they faced, you know, their own ethnic and religious cleansing and lost their land.
So this is where, as we lead up to the war, there's this disastrous and ultimately genocidal doctrine that they develop, the Committee of Union and Progress, and it's called the idea of governability. And it's a demographic doctrine and it's a racial doctrine where they come to think they can only govern territories where the super majority is Turkish and Muslim. So after 1913, they start thinking of how to make this happen, how to produce a demographic policy to make this the case. And they call it, it comes to be called or understood as the 5-10% principle. So the idea is to move Christians around Anatolia so that they're dispersed and in no particular district, and you don't specify the size of the district, but in no particular area are they more than that percent, more than 5-10% of the population. And so in the name of that idea of governability and the 5-10% principle is how this genocide, that's the underlying doctrine for this whole genocide. And between 1914 and 1920, they, in the name of this governability, they had displaced, expelled, or killed 1/3 of the pre-war population of Anatolia of 17.5 million. Before the before the big massacres of Armenians, there were big massacres of Ottoman Greeks. So from 1913 to 1914, there were, the majority of Ottoman Greeks were either massacred or expelled into Greece. The massacres of Greeks were suspended in November 1914 when the Ottoman ally Germany urged them not to stop. So they were relocated to the interior, and massacres against Greeks didn't resume until the interwar period in 1913, where we'll get back to that.
Very big exchange of population there, yeah.
Yeah, the forced population exchange with Greece. We'll get back to that in due time. Then now the Ottoman Armenians, according to Taner Akçam, were different because they were really targeted for total destruction. If they survived the deportation, they were forcibly resettled in Syria and Iraq. The six historically Armenian provinces of eastern Anatolia were emptied, and these had been the areas, not coincidentally, where Armenians had already won a lot of political and national rights in the Armenian Reform Agreement of February 1914. So there was this agreement where they would have participation in local government, and they would be able to be the leaders of these six historically Armenian provinces. And that's what triggers this governability crisis and this idea that we have to disperse them, because the Committee of Union and Progress came to believe that if they were allowed to form local governments in these six provinces, that's a prelude to Armenian statehood. That's a prelude to independence guaranteed by the Western imperialist powers. So even when they were forcibly resettled, they still were kept under 10% in the areas they were forced to go to in Syria and Iraq. And I mean, if you're under the control of a state that's watching what percentage of the population you are, man, that's, you know, there's nothing worse than that, right? That's you're in a genocidal situation. So because of this, February 1914 agreement, they were the Turkish state believed that these six Armenian provinces were the nucleus of a future Armenian state. So they were trying to eliminate this Armenian reform problem, and Mehmet Talat, the interior minister, wanted to eliminate this problem, quote, in a comprehensive and absolute manner.
And oh boy.
We don't like this kind of language.
No, I actually checked about four or five different sources, and I guess it depends on the translation, but
yeah,
some of them translate it as the Armenian question,
right?
Which is never a good.
Yeah.
Good phrasing. And comprehensive and absolute manner also sounds a lot like final solution.
Sure.
Or definitive solution. You don't like hearing things like that.
So, oh yeah, yeah, you're up.
So the Ottomans entered the war on the side of Germany. We know that. We also covered how they immediately invaded Russian territory in the Caucasus in the winter of 1914-15, and that invasion was a disastrous failure. They lost the Battle of Sarikamish in January of 1915, and then the retreat across the mountains in the winter basically destroyed almost the entire army. So how could something like this have happened? Well, it was blamed on Armenian treachery. There had been some desertions. I read that military requisitions in terms of food, but I think also in terms of, you know, drafting soldiers, fell disproportionately heavily on certain groups, including Armenians.
Yeah.
But now we suspect them of treachery. So Armenian soldiers and officers were removed from their posts in February. That didn't take long.
Yeah.
And there were some isolated incidents of resistance. I found it difficult to locate exactly what these were. I don't know if desertion qualifies.
Yeah, there was desertion, and there was a lot of fighting deserters and fighting back against reprisals.
Right, like refusal to surrender your weapons and things like that.
Yeah, and like, we're going to burn your village because you're a deserter, and then there's a fight over the...
Yeah, so these little things were taken as proof that there was a general insurrection on the way.
So Gunter Levy, or G-U-E-N-T-E-R, and then L-E-W-Y, has a book, University of Utah Press, 2005, The Armenian Massacres in Ottoman Turkey, a Disputed Genocide. So this is going to be a little different from Tanner Akçam. And when I read the blurb for the book, it says something like, he avoids the stale, you know, dead end of asking whether it was a genocide or not, and just writes about what actually happened. And okay, on the one hand, I'm like, you know, it's good to read about, who doesn't want to read about what actually happened, right? But on the other hand, is it really a stale? You know? Anyway, I was a little suspicious, and I think I was right. There's stuff in here that's worth reading for sure, but I think he's, I don't know exactly how to put it. Let's just say that he's more sympathetic to the idea that there was lots of Armenian rebellion. So in his view, Armenians viewed Russia as their protector, and the Russian army that was fighting Turkey included a lot of Russian Armenians. So superficially, or like on the surface, the Armenian community, the official representatives, the Armenian patriarch all affirmed their loyalty to the Ottomans, and most Armenians responded to the Ottoman call for military service. But probably in their hearts, I guess, according to Gunter, they were pro-allies. They were pro-Russian. And there's a Turkish cartoon that Gunter Levy quotes from this time. And it depicts a Turk saying basically that how he knows who's winning in the war is he looks around at the Armenians around him. And when they're happy, I know the English, French, Russians are winning. When they're depressed, I know the Germans had a victory. So another sign, I guess, of, you know, the accusation that they're traitors, right?
Mm-hmm.
In September, September 1914, the Ottomans order surveillance of the Armenian organizations and the disarmament. So they go in and they search these communities for weapons. They find weapons. The Armenians say they're for self-defense, but by this time already there are a lot of Armenians deserting, and some Armenians are beginning their revolutionary activities, you know, sabotage and things like that. So Tanner Akçam now refers to this battle of Sarıkamış. What did you call it?
Sarıkamış.
Yeah. So January 1915, they lose, more or less the entire army. 60,000 soldiers die, most of whom freeze to death in the Caucasus Mountains. Many more desert and turn to brigandage. They just become bandits. February 15th, like you said, there's already this order against Armenians, but there's also another big defeat. So February 1915, Kemal Pasha's Fourth Army is defeated by the English in Egypt. In the first canal expedition. Have we already talked about that?
Yeah.
And then the other problem is, from the Ottoman Turkish perspective, is that they were hoping that Indian Muslims and Egyptian Muslims were going to revolt against England, and nothing really came of that. Remember, that was one of Sykes's big worries. So at this point in 1915, Tanner Akçam says, almost everyone believed that the capture of Istanbul was imminent. At the main trial of Unionist leaders after the war, 1919-20, one witness testified that it wasn't known in what sort of condition Istanbul would be 8 hours hence. So we're talking about a lot of panic from the Turkish side about being dismembered. So February 25th, 1915, the Turkish General Staff order this, they send around this increased security precautions memo, and it directs, as you mentioned, the removal of Armenians from military service without exception. Armenian recruits are to no longer be employed in any armed service, either in active and mobile army units, or in either mobile or stationary gendarmerie or police units, and are no longer allowed to serve in the retinues of or offices of military staff or headquarters. So that's a very bad sign, right?
Purge.
February 28th, the Interior Minister Talat tells governors to take all necessary preventive measures. Preventive measures. So this means like rounding Armenians up, etc. By April 1915, the Turkish are saying publicly that the Armenian guerrilla fighters are gathering momentum. The Ministry of the Interior says there are about 30,000 under arms, 15,000 with the Russian army and the other 15,000 in the rear. The U.S. ambassador follows the same estimate, but Taner Akşam does a bit of a detailed analysis and says he doesn't think that could possibly be true. He doesn't think that the local community had that kind of numbers. Most of the men that could fight were already drafted, and yeah, they were purged in February, but they didn't all just come back to their community.
Or are they counting Russian Armenians in the Russian army?
Yeah, I think they are too. So they're saying, I mean, they're doing everything possible to inflate the numbers, right? Mm-hmm. Double count them and stuff. Then we have the British attack on the Dardanelles, which we've covered, and Russia's also advancing into these districts in eastern Anatolia. And that's when you get this order by Kamel Pasha, the Third Army commander on April 22nd of 1915. So I'll read the whole order, and there are similar orders that follow. This is basically the deportation order. The order goes like this: to preserve the life and existence of our nation, it has become necessary, if distressing, to punish with full severity and deport those who have revolted. The provincial officials and acting army corps commanders have been notified by telegrams on 7th and 8th of April 1915 that all of those bearing weapons have been employed when necessary, that individuals between the ages of 46 to 50 have been put under arms, and that while taking care not to harm the population still loyal to the state or those who are defenseless, the decision has been made to mercilessly extirpate down to the last man all traitors who are conducting armed revolt against the government. So that's pretty bad. Austrian ambassador, May 1915, doesn't think that the idea of an Armenian uprising is really happening. He thinks it's exaggerated. One German vice consul says, yeah, the guerrillas are active, but there's no general and planned rebellion. But then another German vice consul says that the rebellion is excellently organized in all of Anatolia. There's a Canadian historian, Gwyn Dyer, who wrote a book in 1973 about the end of the war from the Turkish perspective. And it might have been his master's thesis or something. But he says,
yeah, I met Gwyn Dyer.
Yeah. And so most of his books are from the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And onward, he's written books into the 2000s, but the 1973 book, it's like the first book by 15 years. So I suspect it's like his graduate work or something.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. But he says the accusations of disloyalty, treason, and revolt by Armenians were, and this is Gwyn Dyer's words, wholly true as far as Armenian sentiment went, only partly true in terms of overt acts, and totally insufficient as a justification for what was done to the Armenians. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it, actually. Like,
it is.
They don't have to be innocent to not be victims, or like you're not allowed to genocide people because they're not innocent, right? Like, you're not allowed to genocide people because they're in revolt against you. Nothing. Right.
Well, you make these public proclamations and you tell the Armenians, okay, you must surrender all of your weapons.
Yeah.
And then, you know, surrender your property. So, no.
No, yeah. And so you're not allowed to be in the army, and we're accusing you of treason, and we're going to execute anybody who's doing treason. And by the way, the Russians are coming, and there are lots of Armenians among them, so we're suspecting you of treason already.
Yeah, so give us your weapons and your land and submit. Yeah. So in April, the Armenians in the city of Van organized to defend themselves. Somebody said they blockaded themselves, or they're basically organizing for defense, right? And this provides a basis for the Turkish claim that this is an uprising, this is rebellion.
Yeah, so this is a hugely important event in this history of this genocide, because Van is an important city close to the Russian border, and the Armenian Revolutionary Federation was formed in 1890. They're called the Dashnaks.
Right.
And I guess that must be like an acronym or something. Like if you say Armenian Revolutionary Federation in Armenian, it probably comes out sounding like Dashin or something. Dash. Anyway, Dashnaks. So there was also a revolutionary party called the Hunchaks, formed in 1887, but then it split in 1896 and kind of became irrelevant. So the Dashnaks kind of took up the mantle from 1896 on. So in Van, in 1913, there's a lot of problems, which you alluded to at the beginning, between Armenians and local Kurds. There are these Kurdish brigands that are shaking Armenians down. The Armenians are organized for armed self-defense. The local Dashnaks oppose conscription. So when the government issues a conscription order, they resist. There's a militia that rob and pillage and burn Armenian houses as punishment for not following a conscription order. So in March 1915, there's insurrection. And according to Gunter Levy, the rebellion quickly took on the character of an intercommunal war. Armed Armenian bands attacked Kurdish villages. Kurdish tribesmen then retaliated by attacking Armenian villages. Wholesale massacres followed on both sides. So Armenians, on April 20th, the Armenians of Van, led by this revolutionary Dashnak leader named Aram Manukian, attack police stations and barricade themselves in the Armenian quarter of the city. They're besieged. They're attacked with heavy weapons, including cannon. And there's a South American soldier, Rafael de Nogales. I'll look him up the next time I get a chance while you're talking.
What are you doing there?
Rafael de Nogales was fighting on the Turkish side, and he said that in this battle, nobody gave quarter nor asked for it. He says the Christian or Moor who fell into the enemy's hands was a dead man. After a four-week siege, the Russians took the town. The advancing Russians took the town. On May 20th, Russian-Armenian units entered the town, followed by Russians. And the local Armenians gave the Russian general the keys to the city. Aram Manukian was appointed governor of the region. They, with great fanfare, burned the Turkish military and administrative buildings and maybe possibly executed the Turkish prisoners. So this is the kind of thing that the Turks make a lot out of. They say that there were huge excesses between May and August by the Armenians in the city against the Turkish population. Mm-hmm. But then when the Turks retake Van in August 1915 from the Russians, the Armenians charge that they massacred tens of thousands of Armenians. So one question that Tanner, or it might be Tanner or Gunter, asks, but if the Turkish massacres were in fact precipitated by the uprising in Van, it is tough to explain why deportations of Armenians started 2 weeks before the uprising in Van. And four Dashnak leaders, including two members of parliament, were assassinated weeks before the uprising in Van. Mm-hmm. So that's the chronology is a little bit strained in terms of the Turkish argument that this was all because of what happened in Van. But there's another thing causing Turkish paranoia about Armenians, and that's the Armenian diaspora. So in Bulgaria, the Dashnak organization offers to land 20,000 Armenian volunteers to attack one of these Anatolian provinces of Cilicia.
Okay, if you don't have a map available to you, Cilicia is not one of the six eastern provinces. It is on the southern coast of Anatolia.
Where you can make a where you can make a landing.
Yeah, so now the Turks would see, you know, they're going to attack us in different places.
Right.
I don't know.
It's always Cilicia. The landing is always Cilicia. The Armenian national delegation in Egypt, headed by Bogos Nubar, they offer Armenian volunteers. The Armenian National Defense Committee of America offers volunteers for El Cilicia landing. The same offer is made to Sir John Maxwell by the National Defense Committee in Cairo. So the British come to the conclusion that it's not worth it. Sir Harold Nicholson writes in November 15th, 1915, in a memo. He says the geographic, strategic, and other reasons would render it impossible for the Allied troops to render such assistance to Armenian insurgents as would save them from extermination the moment the movement was discovered. So they viewed it as a hopeless plan. But if the Turkish intelligence got wind of this plan, that's already going to be bad for Armenians in Turkey. There's an Armenian legion of by 1918, there's an Armenian legion of 4,000 fighters. By 1918, they're trained in Cyprus, and then they're sent to Palestine with Allenby. So you'll hear more about them. And the French, after that, sent them to occupy Cilicia, where they engaged maybe in some reprisals on the local Turks for what was done in 1915-16. So about the trial, well, just to make a note about the trial, we'll come back to the trial in a few minutes, but the court martials of some of these people in some of the Committee and Union Progress leaders and military leaders during this period, they're court martialed in 1919-20 in Istanbul. And a fair amount of evidence came out, and the judges came to the conclusion that the whole claim of an Armenian insurrection was greatly exaggerated. And Enver Pasha and Kemal Pasha were both sentenced to death. And there's a whole book, like I said, edited by Taner Akçam and another writer named Vahan Dadrian, D-A-D-R-I-N. So this is not a situation where there's like an international criminal court, right? Or a Nuremberg tribunal. This is the Ottomans trying their own criminals, court-martialing them for losing the war and committing these massacres. And then we have
actually what I read about the trial sounded almost comical. The evidence presented was pretty shoddy. Mm-hmm. And a number of the defendants were warned, advised, or helped to flee into remote parts of Anatolia to avoid prosecution.
Yeah. And anyway, in 1913, the new leader of Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, basically pardons the other. He kind of issues an official pardon for everybody from these court martials. So that's when the Armenian Dashnaks organize something they call Operation Nemesis, and they go around assassinating people that were officials during the genocide.
Yeah. If you're confused by Hunchaks and Dashnaks, it Justin's correct. It comes from pronunciation in Armenian. And then just to make matters more complicated, there's a significant difference, I think, between Eastern and Western Armenian when it comes to language. So Hunchak means bell or like a clarion, and it was the name of the newspaper of the Social Democrat Party, founded in 1887, whereas Dashnak is the ARF, the Armenian Revolutionary and Socialist and Nationalist Political Party. I don't know how prominent the Hunchaks were, but the ARF were definitely the more popular.
Organized. Yeah.
So the Armenians, as I said, were not just in the East. You had plenty in Cilicia, but you also had Armenians living in Constantinople. And systematic deportation began there. They passed a special law on May 27th. So first they arrested intellectuals and I guess people they considered leaders in Constantinople. But then the Turks created the special organization, and it's hard to figure out exactly what this is. It's paramilitary police.
Yeah.
But some sources say that they were secret. I don't see how secret they were, but these special organization forces were assigned to guard the deportation convoys. So Armenians were rounded up and forced to move, guarded, or rather not guarded, by special organization paramilitaries. So the convoys, mostly women, children, and the elderly, because you drafted most of the young men for the army, right? And then told them that they couldn't be in the army, and where are they now? So these convoys, mostly women, children, and the elderly, were marched into the Syrian desert. And they were on the way subjected to robbery, rape, murder, massacre. And then those who survived the march, some sources call them death marches, those who survived were placed in makeshift camps and left there to die of starvation. Makeshift camps means, you know, they didn't There's have nothing camps for them. Prepared. Yeah. Yeah, we just basically parking you here and then leaving you. So there were an estimated 1.5 to 2 million Armenians in the Ottoman Empire. And the sources seem to agree that somewhere around 800,000 or maybe even over 1 million were deported.
Yeah.
That's a pretty significant operation.
Yeah. Yeah. So the genocide is like two phases. One is this the death march to the Syrian desert and out of Anatolia. And the second part is once they're dumped in the desert in Syria, where they die of thirst and starvation, and they're still being controlled, ensured that they can't achieve a critical mass, you know, of more than 10%. So and that's how they continue the genocide. So there's a memo, a telegram from Abdulahad Nuri, the resettlement officer in Aleppo, from January 10th, 1916. And it goes like this. Inquiries having been made, it is understood that hardly 10% of the Armenians subjected to the general deportations have reached the places destined for them. The rest have died from natural causes, such as hunger and sickness. Yeah, right. We inform you that we are working to bring about the same result with regard to those who are still alive by using severe measures. So, and that these kinds of documents remove a lot of doubt that this was official policy. Yeah. That's an official telegram by the resettlement officer. That, so there's also a second round of massacres in Deir Ezzor in Syria in that summer of 1916. So these are basically concentration camps. Tens of thousands of people are forced march to them. There's no food, no water. So they just basically starve and die of thirst. So there was a museum there. Deir Ezzor became kind of a memoriam to the Armenian population, and it was destroyed by the Islamic State in 2014. ISIS took that city in 2014 and destroyed all the historical. That's what they do, right? When they take over a city, they destroyed all the historical monuments and everything. And it was basically recovered. It was recaptured by the Assad regime in 2017, and Assad has pledged that he's going to rebuild the museum and the site, but Assad's a little busy at this exact moment, so it's probably going to have to wait a while. Mm. Cultural genocide as well. The physical prior, so this is Taner Akçam, prior to the physical destruction of Armenian communities, the decision was made to gather Armenian children into city orphanages and force them to abandon their religion, language, and culture. There was also religious conversion and assimilation of Armenian children into Muslim households. An estimated 100 to 200,000 Armenians were, what do you call it, forcibly converted.
Yeah, so, forced into marriage.
Yeah.
Forcibly adopted. And some of the sources that I read said, you know, at this period, you could buy an Armenian woman.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So the slave trade was alive and well. There's a whole industry of Armenian genocide denial, you get Turkish history arguing that the Armenians in Anatolia were relocated or resettled, and that this was done for military reasons or security reasons, and therefore a legitimate reaction to a threat or a perceived threat. They claim that the death toll is exaggerated, or that it is attributable to other factors, civil war, disease, bad weather, local officials who went rogue, and the ever-popular Kurdish outlaws. So you're blaming every possible other cause.
It's a kitchen sink defense, right?
Yeah. So there's an American historian, Ronald Suni, who summarizes the Turkish case like this. There was no genocide, and the Armenians were to blame for it.
That's good. I mean, yeah. It's grim, but it's good. There's an Israeli historian, Ilan Pape, and he said something that reminds me of that. He said, most Israelis don't believe in God, but they believe he gave them the land.
yeah, that's good. That's good, too. Denial is taught in Turkish schools. Turks who acknowledge the genocide have faced prosecution for insulting Turkishness. Now, that may sound a little far-fetched. It's not. On our way to Turkey, we were reminded that in Turkey, it is illegal to criticize the memory of Mustafa Kemal.
Well,
there's a Turkish genocide memorial and museum in Igdir province commemorating massacres and persecution committed by Armenians. Now, we're not saying there weren't. There were massacres perpetrated in eastern Anatolia by Russian and Armenian forces. An estimated 60,000 Muslims were killed. So Turkey commemorates the deaths of 60,000, but denies responsibility for the deaths of somewhere around a million. It's an interestingly disproportionate emphasis and reaction. You mentioned the trials in 1919. This was to appease Britain and France. So the Turks held some courts martial. As I said, the evidence was weak and many of the defendants were helped to escape. Afterwards, Mustafa Kemal, later Kemal Atatürk, defended the Ottoman government's policies toward Christians. He said, whatever has befallen the non-Muslim elements living in our country is the result of the policies of separatism they pursued in a savage manner when they allowed themselves to be made tools of foreign intrigues and abused their privileges. Which is pretty much what Akçam says.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound like a denial to me, does it?
No, it's more like yeah, I did coming. It and I'll do it again.
Yeah, you had it coming. You earned it. In at the end of World War I, the Allies signed, you've heard of the Treaty of Versailles, very likely, with Germany. There were separate treaties for Austria, for Hungary, for Bulgaria, and there was a separate treaty for Turkey, the Treaty of Sèvres. It included provisions for an Armenian territory in eastern Anatolia.
Oh, wow.
Those provisions were never carried out. The situation changed in various ways. Turkey invaded Armenia in 1920. There were more massacres in Cilicia and the Caucasus, and an estimated 200,000 more Armenians were killed.
So that could be considered another part of the genocide in a way.
A continuation. Yeah, they weren't finished. And you mentioned Operation Nemesis before. So the ARF were continuing their reprisals by seeking out and eliminating Turkish officials who were responsible. And Did you mention it, Talat?
Yeah, I wanted to. This is the note that I wanted to get people to remember: Talat Pasha and the ARF, the Dashnaks, because they assassinated Talat in 1921. The other thing, you know, I know I guess what you read was fairly dismissive of the court martial. I will say that the court martial did kill. You know, they did execute both Enver Pasha and Kamal Pasha. So two of the, and then Talat, of course, was allowed to escape, but didn't escape for long. So, you know, three of the main principal players in this genocide were executed.
Yeah, I think they lost the power struggle.
Yeah, sure.
I think there are other reasons for their execution beyond guilt.
Absolutely.
And Talat, when he was killed, was in Berlin.
Yeah.
So what, you know, what's he doing in Germany after the war?
Yeah, I mean, lots of them, I guess, did flee.
Yeah.
Just to different parts of Anatolia.
Well, yeah, so, to avoid being purged. I also read that the Armenian assassin was caught and put on trial in Germany and was acquitted.
Wasn't him?
I think it was basically considered a justified homicide.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, the books that I didn't read that I got, but I didn't have time, you know, I thought it would be better to go with what we have from Akçam. But there was what looked like a couple of interesting books about the American and British responses. So there was a book by Peter Balakian, who I guess from his name is American Armenian, The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. And then there was one by Michel Toussaint, The British Empire and the Armenian Genocide. And they talk about like these, another set of blue books, right? So the British compiled a huge dossier about the Armenian Genocide. And there was quite a bit of campaigning, public awareness during the war of what the Turks were doing to the Armenians. Just by way of saying, like, there was at least some kind of evidence to draw on, and probably people depending on the jury or the judges in Berlin, they would have known about all of this evidence and during the trial of the assassin. So Taner Akçam talks about why, you know, it's hard to deny this, but the basic evidentiary problem, which enables denying what happened, is that a lot of the deportation and massacre orders were communicated outside official government channels. So by phone, there's a witness testimony, but not documents, that attest that Talat Pasha himself was directing the deportations by phone. So Taner Akçam says, this is a longer quote, even though the CUP, the Committee of Union and Progress, made every effort to disguise its crimes, the state's full resources were required to execute an operation of historic immensity which impacted the lives of millions. Inevitably, such an enormous crime left traces among official state documents. The ethnic cleansing of the Ottoman Greeks and the genocidal policy against the Armenians can be demonstrated through these documents alone. So that's what the point that Taner Akçam continues to go back to is, you don't need to use the British blue books. You don't need to use the imperialist sources that were kind of interested. You can come to the conclusion that there was a genocide just by reading carefully the documents from the Turks at this time. You know, Akçam, having been persecuted for his work on this topic, he argues at the end that this is quite harmful both to the profession of history and to Turkish society that there's this silence on these massacres. He says, by refusing to investigate mass annihilations, traditional Ottoman historians have failed to confront the mentality of those who perpetrate these convulsively destructive episodes. And because of this, he says, society has lost its moral sensitivity to past genocide as well as to current and possibly future episodes of mass violence. What do you think, Dave? Do you think society's not sensitive enough to mass violence? I think you could probably make that case in 2024.
Lost its moral sensitivity. I think you would have to have some moral sensitivity first.
Well, there is that.
Yeah.
So that is, for now, what I have to say about the Ottoman situation in 1915-16. We'll come back to the Arab, the T.E. Lawrence, Allenby, and that part of the war a little bit later. Where are we headed now?
Back to the war itself. 1916 was awful. Two of the words to describe it are agony and slaughter.
So that's what we've got for you next, agony and slaughter.